Chapter 30. It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 30. Headed for Hitler's Berchtesgaden. Bill, Norbert, and I were a bit on the weary and unhappy side when we left Vienna early on a Wednesday morning. Nobody spoke, not even I, to anybody else for miles and miles. Bill had viewed Vienna in the moonlight from the Kahlenberg and had had donuts and ice cream for breakfast. Senseless as it seems, life for Americans in poverty-stricken Vienna is exceedingly soft and gay. As the GIs are fond of saying, the soldiers stationed there never had it so good. Our generous Uncle Sam provides them with everything, particularly the colonels, and if there were any other ranks in the United States Army in Vienna except colonels, I never met them. Oh, I take it back. I did meet the head of the whole works, General Jeffrey Keyes, but the colonels are thick as cows in Texas. Not that I'm complaining, you understand. I like colonels, and these colonels and their ladies, if they have ladies, live in luxury in the United States government-run Bristol Hotel, or in delightful houses in the suburbs of Vienna. In my short visit, I didn't have time to investigate life in the suburbs, but I did make a pretty thorough study of it in the Bristol, and I can report with authority that it is easy and exceedingly pleasant. Take the towels, for instance. They are as big as double bed-sized sheets and as thick and soft as the finest bath mats, and all day and night they rest on a towel rack of heated rods, unaccustomed as I am to heated rods in prospect. I leaned up against these the first evening and practically branded myself. Then there are the bells to ring when you feel the need or desire for anything. There are three of these bells in a row, and opposite the bells there are pictures of the people whom you may expect when you ring. By the top bell is a drawing of a maid in the most approved uniform. By the second, the drawing of a most proper-looking waiter, and by the third, a porter. He didn't look up to Bristol standards to me. He didn't have a coat. He didn't have on a coat. I was always tempted when I stood before these bells to ring all of them. Usually I got myself in hand in time to poke only for the waiter, for he appeared with breakfast. When he appeared with breakfast, he brought everything. For just one breakfast, there were oranges and prunes, pep, a pitcher of cream, two fried eggs and bacon, hot rolls, coffee, and marmalade. Naturally, after consuming this, I wasn't able to do any sightseeing until lunch, and then I could just drag myself down to the dining room and sightsee the midday meal. It was hard, I tell you. All the meals were fine, but the best were in the evenings, for along with soup and steak and potatoes and lettuce salad, and soccer torts, there was a brightly dressed gypsy orchestra that played wildly and beautifully from the first course until the last. Every dinner was a party. A colonel and his wife would ask any number of other colonels and their wives who were staying at the Bristol to dinner, and it didn't cost them an extra penny. Everyone in the hotel paid a regular mess fee, and no matter who ate with whom, the fee was always the same. After cocktail parties, and there seemed to be cocktail parties daily, the dinners were large and numerous. People staying in the Bristol were busy as they could be at the cocktail parties, rushing about asking people who also stayed in the Bristol to join them for dinner. Of course, if they made a mistake and asked people who lived out in town, they had to pay for them. After dinner, everyone moved as a body to the nightclub in the basement of the hotel. Here, an excellent dance orchestra played nightly, including Sundays, until 1. The leader had a good tenor voice, and between dances he roamed among the tables, playing a guitar and singing. There was even a fine floor show. So naturally, after living so well, I might add, strenuously for 4 days, my two companions and I were in no mood for the road, but the road it had to be. We were due in Geneva that very day, and here we were hundreds and hundreds of lake and mountain miles away. Our conscience consciences gnawed at us. The first part of that morning, we drove through Russian-occupied Austria, and it is the breadbasket of the country. The Russians seem to have a habit of always taking the richest sections of the countries which the Allies occupy and leaving us, of the United States, the most rugged. I suppose we don't like to be selfish about these things. The breadbasket section is a rich valley, as carefully tended as a country club's golf course. There is not a neglected foot. Right at the edge of the highway, the grain grows green and thick and even. Women with rakes twice as wide as our rakes at home were out in the fields pulling long golden ruffles of hay behind them. Now and then, one of them would stop and, leaning on the rake handle, watch us go by. It was hard driving, for all along the road were those narrow, trough-shaped carts of the Austrians, heaped to the brim with wet manure. Every peasant had chosen that morning, it seemed, to empty his barn, which is connected with his house in the village, of its winter collection. The manure had been thoroughly dampened and molded in the carts as slick and shiny as walnut-stained coffins, so that not even one flake could drop away. I like broad, open fields patterned in new green and plowed earth, almost as much as gushing rivers and snow-capped mountains. But that morning, every time I owed and awed over the fertile countryside, Bill Sharp talked me. "That I should have lived so long," he growled. "You are inflating the language until it isn't worth a damn thing to anybody. What do you think beautiful means now after you've used it 1,000 times? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And that goes for lovely and wonderful, too." And on he would go, encouraged, of course, by Norbert, who never was enthusiastic about any adjective except nice, which I think is the nambiest, pambiest, most anemic adjective there is. But when Bill really exploded was when I raved about the copper-green steeples of the churches far off in the valleys, pointing like curled leaves into the bright blue sky. Just a glimpse of a steeple and he would howl, "Ah," almost stripping his vocal cords. He complained, too, at my enthusiasm for the quaint little towns through which we passed. But that was the Austrians' fault, not mine. They built them. Anybody except a hard-boiled newspaper man would love them. The houses in an Austrian village are flush with the street and are built of stucco. Each facade is narrow and pointed at the top like a child's drawing of a house. And here she has a picture, a little picture of a house. Even I can do it. And across the facade are painted biblical characters or bunches of flowers or hunting scenes or heaven knows what. The houses lean shoulder to shoulder and frequently they stagger down the narrow crooked streets like flashily dressed drunks. When we would swing into one of these tiny light opera-ish looking villages, I would go off into my string of adjectives. Bill would snap, "Well, all I can say is I hope to God we don't meet a wagon or a truck on this oh-so-quaint, precious little street." From the Soviet-occupied area of Austria, we went into our own. A big sign greeted us. "Welcome to the U.S. zone, Austria." A pink-cheeked sergeant in the old familiar khaki and helmet collected our passports and Allied force permits. While they were being examined, we sat on the bank of the river that marked the boundary line and looked at the little town of Enns on the far side, an old-world town if I ever saw one. Thick, wide walls along the river shore, a square gray stone clock tower, a steep-roofed Gothic church, and yellow stucco houses with weathered red tiles zigzagging up the hillside. We ate that noon in a United States Army mess and remembered once again they never had it so good. The mess was in a handsome house high on a hill and beautiful petite point sofas and chairs and brilliant tapestries. 8 officers live in the mountains, and a good many others come in for meals. We had thick hamburgers smothered in onions and a jelly roll cake. The ride that afternoon was the loveliest we'd had. The spacious valleys that had stretched away from the roadside all morning began to be pushed in by mountains. Great masses of them gathered quickly like a storm against the sky. That long, rather flat-topped one over there is known as the Sleeping Greek, Norbert told us, pointing to a mountain standing a bit aloof from the others. I studied it, but I could see no Sleeping Greek. Instead, it looked exactly like the tilted back head of Mr. Roosevelt, which, when I said as much, ruined the mountain for Republican Norbert. Another group was known as either Frozen Ocean or Frozen Sea. I can't remember which now, but either is perfect. Like giant waves tipped with foam, they pitched high and wild into the clear, sun-filled air. Every curve in the road brought more mountains, white with snow, more valleys, expertly pieced together with their oblong scraps of greens and browns, and more villages exclaimed over by slim green church steeples. There were even blue lakes and foaming rivers. I never before saw such a picture postal card land. Once, when I opened my mouth to exclaim over something, Bill rushed in with, "I know, you never imagined." I grinned sheepishly. "I know," he said. "You've already never imagined about 2,000 times today." On reaching the music festival city of Salzburg, which looks as if it might have been dropped from the sky into the slit between the mountains made by the furiously racing Inn River, we left our bags at a United States Army-run hotel and drove 9 miles to Hitler's old stamping ground at Berchtesgaden. And here happened what Bill, all during the trip, had been predicting would happen. I had no adjectives left to describe the mountain world of Berchtesgaden. "It is beyond compare," I kept saying. "Beyond compare of what?" he grinned, kept prodding me, and of course I didn't know. The road to Berchtesgaden is a 6-lane, perfectly paved highway which Hitler built at a cost of many millions, leads along a narrow valley mountained in by fur-papered peaks. On both sides, the peaks vault straight towards the sky. It is neck-breaking. Hitler's own mountain, which we spotted a long way off because we could see the rather square affair that is the Eagle's Nest, squatting on its top, was to the left of our road. Towards sunset, we began to climb it. I was delighted with the hour. The slopes had a soft purplish cast, and a white mist roamed in the valley. "It is lovely," I cried. "Lovely by now doesn't mean a thing," said Bill. "It is beautiful," I tried again. "I told you back in Macedonia, remember, not to use your adjectives on that sad valley with a few willows and peach blossoms," lectured Norbert. "It is wonderful," I tried next. "You said that about every flea-bitten village we passed through," Bill declared. "Well, I haven't said magnificent and stupendous and gorgeous." "Oh, yes, you have," Bill's voice was stern. "You said everything. You've worn out every adjective in the dictionary." I was dejected. I could see now I'd made a mistake. I really should have saved the best ones for this hour and place. "All right," I admitted. "I've been wrong. Now what do you, who haven't used up your adjectives, say about it?" "I say," pronounced Bill importantly, "I say Mr. Hitler knew how to choose his retreats, even if he didn't know when to make them." His big shoulders shook with his chuckles. He was simply enchanted with himself. End of chapter 30.